Hello and welcome to The Hated and the Dead with Tom Lehman. Having completed an episode last year on the Caribbean island country of the Dominican Republic, today we turn to the country with which the Dominican Republic shares an island. The island is Hispaniola and the country is Haiti. Haiti and the Dominican Republic's trajectories, especially over the last 30 years, have been remarkably stark. Despite having more or less the same population, Haiti's economy is 10 times smaller than the Dominican Republic's. In fact, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and its current travails, making headlines across the world, are merely the latest in a seemingly never-ending cycle of exploitation, international interference, and government collapse. In 1990, though, Haitians put their faith in somebody to break that cycle. Jean-Bertrand Aristide ran for the Haitian presidency on a platform promising to bring democracy to Haiti and respect to its poor. Aristide's background, as a priest committed to helping the poor who had survived multiple assassination attempts, unsurprisingly struck a chord with the Haitian population, and he won the election in a landslide. Over the next 14 years, Aristide served as Haiti's president on three different occasions. But the overall course and tone of his political career was set very early, in 1991, when after just 8 months in power, Aristide was removed in a coup. Though coups have been all too common an occurrence throughout Haitian history, the removal of Haiti's new democratic lightning rod caused Aristide to become a living martyr, the president robbed of his chance to save his country. As you're about to hear, Aristide's reformist agenda never recovered from the 1991 coup, and his time in power can be interpreted as the overture to Haiti's present crisis. It is one of the most crushing stories I've covered on this series, but my guest also provides hope in the form of stories about the enormous cultural and communal wealth of Haiti and its people. That guest is Rosa Friedman. Rosa is a professor of law, conflict and global development at the University of Reading and has published extensively on the United Nations, international human rights law, sexual exploitation and abuse in conflict, and Haiti. The internationalism of Rosa's research interests reflects the fact that what's happened in Haiti for decades has not happened in isolation, but reflects international decisions far beyond the control of ordinary Haitians. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to introduce Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Hi, Rosa. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. We are discussing Jean-Bertrand Aristide today. He was the president of Haiti numerous times in the 1990s and early 2000s. As we'll find out today, his various cracks at the presidency were interrupted by coups and general instability within the Haitian political system. And this instability has been more or less a constant feature of Haiti's time as an independent country. To start off with, what do you think is important to know about Haiti, about its formation and about its history in order to lay the groundwork for understanding the highly precarious and dangerous place that it has been, unfortunately, for many, many decades now?
To understand Haiti, we really have to go back to the island that was discovered by Christopher Columbus. He landed in Haiti and he sent 50 or so of his men to look into the island as he sailed off. And by the time he came back, they disappeared. They'd probably, you know, mixed with the locals, not to be seen again. But it was a very welcoming indigenous population, like many indigenous populations were, that ended up being colonized and slaughtered and brutalized by empires. And over the next few hundred years, Haiti ended up being divided between the French and the Spanish. The island where Haiti is, it actually shares an island with Dominican Republic. And Dominican Republic was ruled over by the Spanish Empire. And the French went into Haiti and brutalized the country. They slaughtered pretty much all of the indigenous population and then brought black African slaves over. The type of plantations that they had in Haiti were so brutal. The violence was absolutely off the charts, probably only up there with what King Leopold did in Congo. That type of violence, you know, the cutting off of people's hands or killing of their children if they didn't meet their quotas on plantations. And at one point, Haiti was responsible for more than 50% of the world's sugar cane. It's a very resource-rich country, and it was very heavily sort of farmed for those resources. That brutalization led to Haiti becoming the first black sovereign state in the world. It was the first country to overthrow slavery. The revolution took place over a period of a little more than a decade, where they overthrew the French. The French came back in, and then they overthrew them again. And as the world's first black sovereign nation, they were also the first country to ban slavery and the first country to coin the term white supremacy, which we all use today. The result of Haiti becoming free, they called it the Haitian Empire at the beginning, they had an emperor, was that countries around the world did not want this to be replicated elsewhere within their empires, and they did not want this black sovereign nation to rule over itself, to show that, you know, black people can govern over themselves, just like all other races. So this is the really important starting point for understanding Haiti and the international interference in Haiti and the racism, because we might as well label it what it is. It is just blatant racism, this idea that Haitians have never been allowed to choose who governs over them. The other really crucial part of understanding this small and very resource-rich but culturally vibrant country is to understand that France demanded that Haiti pay reparations for every single slave that they have freed in the revolution. And in today's terms, we're talking about billions upon billions of dollars. Now that money, remembering that Haiti is so resource rich, so it was making good money, but that money going to France meant that Haiti couldn't invest in its own roads or healthcare, its infrastructure, its schools. So despite being so resource rich, it has been economically less developed and materially on the ground less developed than all of its neighbours, including Dominican Republic that it shares an island with. And nowhere is it more obvious than in 2010 when there was an earthquake on the island that caused absolute devastation in parts of Haiti, particularly Port-au-Prince, the capital, and caused almost no damage in Dominican Republic because Dominican Republic had enough infrastructure, buildings that had building regulations that weren't shacks, that, you know, roads that had been built properly, things like that, to withstand the same earthquake that caused this destruction. It's really crucial to understand those two points, to understand both the what's going on today in Haiti, but also the kind of politics of revolution in Haiti and the psyche within the country and the way that the country and many of the individuals in the country view the international community.
The various different meddlings in Haiti's affairs, as you've mentioned, caused a great deal of resentment among the Haitian people, particularly the black Haitian population across the 20th century. Aristide, our subject today, was born in 1953, almost exactly halfway through the century. And this was at a time when black Haitian disillusionment and nationalism, noirisme, as it was referred to, was about to be channeled in particular through one political figure who became Haitian president in 1957. That was, of course, François Duvalier. Who was Duvalier and why has he become such a notorious figure in Haitian history?
Yeah, in order to understand who Duvalier was and how he came into power, we actually have to go back a little bit further in that century. And we have to think about the time between, well, in the middle of the First World War through to just before the Second World War, where the US essentially occupied Haiti. They came in and they said Haitians couldn't run their own country. And they set up a system which was almost like slavery, you know, paying very low wages for very high maintenance work. And even though it wasn't called colonization, it was certainly an occupation. And since that time, the US has continued to interfere in Haitian affairs. Now, think about the politics of the United States. The idea that you had a black sovereign nation ruling over itself at a time when in America they were going through, first of all, the ideas of what universal suffrage is. Yes, of course, they had universal suffrage, but so many states had these laws around poll tax that basically prevented black men and women from voting. And then you had the Jim Crow laws and segregation. So you can see why the US was so threatened. As I said, not only the United States, many of the countries around the world. Actually, you can divide them into two. You've got countries that were threatened by Haiti's independence, and then you had countries like Bolivia and Cuba and Venezuela who credit Haiti with their own independence and their own overthrow of empires. And that's also important when we're understanding what's going on today, which countries are allied or not with Haiti, or is seen as what is termed the group of friends of Haiti. After that time, remember, we're moving into sort of the Cold War, after the Second World War, obviously. We're moving into the Cold War and Cold War politics. And amongst Haitians, the move towards populist leadership was very aligned with the kind of Fidel Castro's, Hugo Chavez, kind of socialist. I say socialist, communist, you know, its own brand, of course, very different in Latin America and Caribbean to what we saw in the USSR or places like that, but very much aligned to that left. And again, that very threatening to the United States, which was starting to think about its campaigns in Vietnam, places like that, you know, these proxy states. So when de Valier comes to power, the United States actually supports him. They understand the brutalizing regime that he then rolls out. But to them, that seems a better thing to support than to support the overthrow of him, free and fair elections, and Haitians to potentially and probably elect a much more left-leaning, possibly socialist. I say socialist in inverted commas because we know that many of these leaders were incredibly repressive of LGBT minorities and other minorities, and that, you know, that they weren't true brand socialists. So de Valier, the father, comes into power, and this starts a reign of, well, slowly, it starts a reign of terror over the country. Remember what I said at the beginning about the brutalizing type of empire that France had run? We're talking about similar types of brutalizing and terrorizing, the types of torture, imprisonment, disappearances that were replicated by, I mean, not on the same scale, but replicated in countries like Cambodia by Pol Pot at similar times.
So de Valier and his son ran Haiti for almost 30 years between 1957 and 1986. Just in terms of some of the developments of the state that the de Valiers put in place, and particularly in terms of repression, can you delve into those just a little more, especially in terms of the development of paramilitary groups? Because I think those become more important as the de Valier regime continues and after.
Yep. So de Valier set up the system of the Tontons, the paramilitary groups. The paramilitary groups almost sounds a little too benign, right? When we talk about mercenary things like that, they're brutalizers. They are largely men, and you know, it is largely men that brutalize in all society throughout history, and they are there to enforce. Look, we see it with dictators all around the world. We'd see it. Saddam Hussein's regime, we know that dictators need to enforce. They might be secular dictators, they might be, you know, regimes, terrorist regimes like ISIS or Hamas or Boko Haram, but they need enforcers on the ground to do their bidding. And de Valier sets up this paramilitaries, the Tontons, that become the enforcers. And if we're thinking about gang violence today, you can draw a direct line from them through to the types of gang violence and the power that the gangs hold, but also the regimes that the gangs support today. Because those groups become the blueprint or the framework for later on Aristide and the gangs that he forms to support him. It's not that there weren't gangs in Haiti before. And again, if we look regionally, we've got Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, El Salvador. We've got many countries in the region with similar waves of gang violence and development of gangs, sometimes criminal gangs and sometimes enforcer gangs. But we can really start drawing that line with the dictatorship of de Valier, much like you can start drawing that line in other countries with their military dictators.
So if we look at Aristide a little more directly, he grew up in the maelstrom
of this very violent regime. How did he personally, in terms of what he believed in and what he did, how did he try to safeguard himself against the worst excesses of Duvalierism?
I mean, if we think about Aristide, he starts off with this very sort of religious education. And to understand this, and sorry that I never answer your questions directly, I have to contextualize them. There's a saying in Haiti that everyone is 100% Christian and 50% voodoo. What does that mean? You've got these slaves, and slaves, the only day they have off is a Sunday to go to church in the morning and maybe to tend a little plot of land if they're given some land, you know, some arable-type farm. Revolution starts on a Sunday is another phrase in Haiti. Sunday is a day that the slaves meet in church, and it's a day they talk, and it's a day that politics happen. And that continues today, where you've got more than 70% of the country who are in the informal economy. Many of them are subsistence farmers in the countryside or working in non-traditional kind of jobs in the cities. I have one friend who, when I used to be in Haiti quite a lot, never went to church on a Sunday. And his wife used to tell him to stay at home because she was embarrassed that he didn't go to church. Everyone goes to church on a Sunday, apart from him. And he'll laugh if he ever hears me say that. He'll know exactly who he is. But this idea that everyone's 50% voodoo, voodoo is the culture and the religion and the belief and traditions in Haiti as well. So it's not surprising that Aristide was educated.
Sorry to interrupt, but you mind just elucidating a bit what voodoo actually means in this context? Because I think people will jump to conclusions maybe that are
voodoo a little inaccurate. Voodoo is certainly not something for me to explain. It's something that I have been around, I have much of respect for, but it's something that is very secret or closed. I mean, if you think about groups like the Druze, right? The Druze don't talk about their religion, right? It's a very strong belief set, but it's not for outsiders. And even amongst my friends in Haiti, you know, occasionally they might talk to me about some voodoo traditions. There's certainly stayed in hotels where it's very clear that there's practice of voodoo, but it's not for me as an outsider to ask. And I would encourage anyone that's interested in voodoo not to think about the kind of things that you might see in a movie, but to go and read about the traditions and the evolution of voodoo, particularly in Haiti. Because if you think that you have an entire population of slaves that have been brought over from Africa, right, with maybe the last vestiges of some indigenous populations, if any people survive, and also mixed race Haitians that are the product of slave owners essentially raping their slaves because there's not much consensual about it. The traditions and beliefs that are then brought over with these slaves are hybridized. They meet this kind of Christian, first of all, through the empires, but later through the many, many missionaries, many church groups that go to Haiti to build houses and bring Christianity to the Haitians. And so it hybridizes with Christianity. So the voodoo in Haiti will be very different to the voodoo that you might find in other parts of the world. It's a way of life. And when I say that everyone's 100% Christian and 50% Haiti, I don't say it. I bastardized that phrase from Creole. It's because you cannot actually separate out the two and the traditions and beliefs. And when you look at Haitian music and art and literature, this infused with it, and there's an amazing children's book, and sorry if I segue a little here, amazing children's book that I bought for one of my children when I was spending a lot of time in Haiti, and I wanted him to understand a little more. And the whole book is in, there's voodoo within it without mentioning it. And it was amazing to me to read this book with him because it's a culture and a belief system that he'd not encountered before, and yet it's just infused through it. So Aristide gets educated in a Christian school, a Catholic school in Port-au-Prince in the capital city. But he spends a lot of time working in communities with the poor. And this is still a legacy of his today, and people who are still not just followers of his, but, you know, true believers in principles that he laid out that stand by this, that you can't just do top-down interventions in communities. If you want to work in communities, you need to live in them. If you want to be a public interest lawyer for the poor or the disenfranchised or people in the countryside, you actually need to live with them And this is, again, going against that idea of imperialism, of bringing in interventions from the middle classes or the cities and telling people what to do, but rather living amongst the people, the communities that you serve. But he was also educated, and he was educated abroad, and this is not unusual. He went to Quebec in Canada, where, of course, French is spoken, French and English are spoken, and many Haitians, there's a big diasporic Haitian community there. And then he returns to Haiti in the mid of the 1980s, and he becomes a priest. And a year later, Devalier, the baby dog, the son, is driven away from power. So that's really sort of his background. He's quite populist. He's very much working with communities as a priest, but as a, you know, as I would imagine sort of nuns used to work in communities. You're not just there sort of working in a spiritual sense, but also getting his hands dirty and working and serving and living amongst these communities. And again, these are important details to understand why he became such a popular figure and why he could command so many sort of groups of individuals. We might call them gangs, but they were groups of individuals that were his followers and that wanted to see him in power and running the country.
So the younger Devalier, Baby Doc, as he was known, leaves Haiti amid popular uprising in February 1986. Obviously, one of the major legacies of the Devalier regime that you've highlighted was the importance of these, for want of a better term, perhaps paramilitary groups, the Tontons. And we've seen it in the cases of many other dictatorial regimes that when the dictator leaves, the influence of these groups doesn't just melt away. Once the dictator has left, you still have these people behind. That's certainly what happened in Iraq, for example, after 2003. Once Devalier had left, who were the most powerful groups and individuals, paramilitary or otherwise, that remained in Haiti?
I mean, as you say, the elites, the ruling elites, remained powerful, and they remain powerful today. And those ruling elites aren't always in government, but they're the ones that control the resources, often selling them very cheaply to international actors. They're the ones who live in big mansions with high security, who are not affected by the gang violence whatsoever. So you had them, and you also had, remember, the military. And you had the role of the church. And Aristides wasn't liked by any of them. In fact, there were assassination attempts on him. He was viewed not
five
just
five or
with,
six, I think, right?
Yeah. And it wasn't just that he was viewed with suspicion. They actively wanted to kill him, to try and move his parish, to try and undermine this populist power that they could see he commanded. And, you know, he's written books about his experiences working in these communities, and you can see that charismatic and someone who understood the struggles of Haitians and someone who was being followed and followed in a good way by masses of people, and therefore a threat to the elites or the militaries, the people that held power for so long and expected to continue to hold that power. So the thing about Haiti is that there's such a vibrant civil society, and there are so many political parties, just so many political actors, even today. They're vying for power. They come in with different agendas, but Aristide sort of didn't fit with any of them. He cut through sort of all of them and managed to anger them all while doing so.
So just to contextualize it in the time then, can you think of, and I can't really think of any off the top of my head, so I'd be interested to see if you can you think of any contemporary or roughly contemporary figures who were kind of equivalents in the world in the global South, a kind of pro the poor populist who kind of fuses these religious and messages with a very sort of Christian message of helping your neighbor and helping the poor?
I mean, I'm struggling, as you can see. I'm struggling to think of it. Often these populist movements come with freedom fighting or terrorism. You know, one man's freedom fighter, another man's terrorist. And they, you know, I'm thinking Nelson Mandela, for example.
That was the closest one I got to him.
Yeah, but that wasn't really through religion. That was through fighting apartheid and racism. And the religious groups that I can think of have morphed today into terrorist groups. So originally, you might say that there were aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood, right? I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was created in the 1920s, and one of its initial reasons for being created was to push Jews out of Israel. But it also had a huge socialist element that was mixed with religion. And the Muslim Brotherhood, and I'm talking about across sort of many countries, I'm not talking about the parts that have been co-opted by Iran and a part of wars, but the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood, of education and socialism and bringing people to religion through actions and feeding the poor, has that similar strain to it. But I actually can't think of any movement like that, including Aristides, that hasn't become corrupted in some way. You can start with those good ideals, you know, but it becomes corrupted along the way. And also, it's important to note that by 1994, Aristide had actually requested to and been relieved of being a religious leader by the kind of by the churches, essentially, because of the way they treated him, because of attacks on church services and assassination attempts, but also because the principles and ethics he was taking forward didn't need to be coming through being a priest. He was actually living those values without needing to tie them to a church.
So before we go on to his presidency specifically then, the period after 1986 remains very, very unstable. You've mentioned the assassination attempts on Aristide. There are two coup d'etats in 1988. Aristide is himself caught up in another assassination attempt in September of that year. I think this sees 13 people die. Do you think that people were surprised by the continuation of problems in Haiti? Had there been an expectation in 86 that things were about to change?
It's hard to know. First of all, that it's hard to know. I was a child at that time, a very small child. And it's hard to look back on history or even to ask my friends of my age, who, again, were toddlers around that time. I think, as with the toppling of any dictator, there's this period of great hope and also great uncertainty. The creation of La Valas by Aristide, which means, I mean, it means a flood, essentially, in Creole, like a torrent, a tidal wave, shows that the people on the ground, not all of them, but huge parts of the population, wanted change and they wanted democracy. They wanted free and fair elections. And this is a catchphrase I use a lot. My mother says that whenever she hears me talk about Haiti on the news, I always use free and fair elections, because it's what Haitians have been demanding and deserve for decades. And in 1990, they got those free and fair elections. But over that period of time, those few years, I think the waves of revolution, these cycles of violence and uncertainty, probably mirrored what happens in many countries. And as we've seen, in some countries, they never then get to the free and fair elections. And in other countries, they are supported to do so.
So Aristide actually became the president of Haiti in 1990. He won the elections of that year, and what are often termed Haiti's first or perhaps their only free and fair elections. To what extent do you think that free and fair bit, as you bring it up there, to what extent do you think it needs nuancing, or how democratic were those elections?
I mean, we can move all the way back and say, hey, what is democracy, right? And that's a whole other issue. One of the things in Haiti is, as I say, revolutions begin on a Sunday. In order to take information to the people, you need to go out beyond the cities. And driving in Haiti is its own special magical pleasure. The roads are not great, and the roads are used by everyone, whether you're taking your goats down the road, or you're on a bicycle, you're walking, you're in a car, you're lying on the top of a flatbed truck or a huge lorry, or anything else. It takes a long time to get to places, and sometimes you will be waiting for hours because there's a local political revolution that involves burning tyres on the road, so you stop and you wait. Do you have to be able to go and meet with the people? The second thing is that where you've got 70% of the people working in the informal economy, you've got to go and meet them on their terms. And you've got to go and meet them at a time, usually a Sunday, when you can organise town hall meetings. Not everyone is literate by a long way. And the information will often be given in French, whereas Creole is the local language. So there were elections and they were democratic elections. There's also issues with voter registration. It costs money to get a birth certificate. So not everyone has one. And the more poor or disenfranchised you are, the less likely you are to have a birth certificate. But I think we can still hold them out as democratic elections with international monitoring or support. And these were the first ones that Haiti had had. So I think free and fair, it certainly was. We're not talking about the kind of elections that we've seen in Zimbabwe through my lifetime, where they're certainly not free and fair. In fact, they can be very dangerous if you don't vote for the right person.
We spoke about Aristide's religious convictions and his religious education, and how this had a very big impact on what he believed. With the benefit of hindsight, do you think that there are things that education did not equip him with, related to particularly the realities of government, of making deals, and of statecraft, really? Do you think he understood the type of compromises that have to be made when you're not, you know, on the outside looking in, when you're actually the one making decisions?
I think he did understand statecraft, and he chose to take forward his principles. He chose to drive forward a literacy program, for example. Empowerment comes through education. He chose to drive forward reforms that we would call human rights, but he might have tied to religion, but to prevent the kind of violations that happened under the Duvalier era and that had become embedded in society from the ruling elites against the mass population. He may well have understood and rejected the type of corruption involved in statecraft in Haiti at that time. And I think he sought to reform the country. As with all reforms, and not all reforms are good, we can think about Liz Truss and her attempted reforms. If you try them too quickly, they're likely either to fail or to be blocked. Now, Liz Truss has failed immediately, right? And we're all living with the consequences. I think with Aristide, he was pushing forward reforms that angered the elites and military because they were going in fast. But again, if he had tried to push those reforms more slowly, first of all, he wouldn't have achieved his aims, but he would also have angered this very strong populist movement that was behind him. So I think at this point, he didn't have many options other than to keep going with the momentum and trajectory that he was on.
Well, certainly to be fair to him, if you're a president that's taken over after an election and your various predecessors have been removed in coups after literally months in power, you're probably going to have a bit of a sweat on to do whatever it is you want to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's continued in Haiti since. You know, it's very dangerous to one's health to seek political power. And if you want to drive through reforms, you better do them quickly. And that's part of this cycle of political instability in the country.
How successfully then does Aristide manage, after he becomes president in 1990, to actually implement those things?
This really depends on who you ask. As I said, there are people who are still not just firm supporters of Aristide, but true believers in everything he did. I'm not sure I would go quite to the point of saying it's cult of the personality, but it's certainly moving in that direction for sizable minorities within the country and outside. What he did was set a framework for dismantling lots of the corrupt sort of local corrupt elites, the frameworks that have been put in place to maintain power in the very few at the expense of the lifestyles, life chances, lives even of the very many. And he set the ball rolling for reforms. He didn't have much time that first time that he was in power. But just because he was ousted in a coup didn't mean that the programs that he put into place just stopped. So he certainly laid the foundations and started the ball rolling for reforms, although reforms have come in piecemeal waves, if one could even say that.
There is a coup attempt against Aristide in 1991, a successful coup attempt. And I was reading, is it Michael Dibert?
Yes.
Yeah, Michael Dibert's a book recently about Haiti, Haiti Will Not Perish. And I just want to read a little quote from it because I think it's quite telling. He says, along with the military-managed post-Duvalier transition period, the 1991 coup remains one of the great tragedies of Haitian history. Whatever he became later, in 1990, the Haitian people had emphatically chosen Aristide as the representative of their collective aspirations, and they were robbed of the chance to see the results of that choice and to evaluate it. That brutal interruption of the democratic process led to total confusion, not only about the immediate fate of the country, but also about the value of the democratic process of itself. I think that tells you quite starkly about the sense of disappointment that many Haitians felt in 1991. And one of the things that Dibert mentions in his book is the kind of recurring character in Haitian history of the tragic martyr. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Aristide didn't die in 1991. He's still alive today. But do you think that in terms of the sort of cult of personality idea that you mentioned shortly ago, do you think that's where his public image becomes solidified, 1991, where power seems to be sort of taken away from him forcefully without the consent of the people who'd voted for him?
Yes, I think it does. And I think that for many people who remain very loyal to him without recognizing any flaws, and that's where I mean cult of the personality, he's frozen in time in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, it was a fork in the road, and for them, he can't be flawed because they're seeing him walking down the fork that doesn't exist, the fork where he wasn't ousted. And but for your listeners who don't speak or read French or Creole, Michael Dibert has written and writes the absolute best and most nuanced work on Haiti. He's spent a lot of time living there, and unlike many people who are not Haitian, who write about Haiti, he doesn't take sides. You don't necessarily know his politics. He's a fantastic journalist, but a fantastic writer, and he brings Haiti to life. Now, I've spent a fair amount of time in Haiti, and I always tell people, and apparently I'm not the only one that feels this way, that a piece of my heart is left in Haiti. Once you've been there, it doesn't leave you. It's.
He says a similar thing.
Soon after the gang violence started, I was doing interviews on international media, and I started just telling people about Haiti, because so much of what people know about Haiti is gang violence. They don't know that Haiti has such beautiful beaches that cruise ships often stop on Haitian beaches but just don't tell people that they're in Haiti, right? And if you go to these beaches, you often have spring break American students there, so don't go at that time. You know, we go with our friends, and for us it costs $5. But their kids only get to go there when they're with us, because Haitians have been outpriced to be able to access their own natural resources. And the artwork, the amount of people that have Haitian artwork that I've brought home, take petroleum cans and turn it into the most beautiful, vibrant pieces for the wall or bowls, or and the colours. And everywhere you go is music. And it's the kind of music that hits your soul. I can't talk enough about Haiti, and particularly with Haiti in terms of the work I do as a human rights professor. It's probably the most vibrant civil society I've ever encountered, proportionate to the size of the population. Civil society runs a country, right? You've got your missionaries, you've got your church groups, you've got your international NGOs that come in, and as Haitians say, they come in, they drive their cars and blow dust up in your face. They come in and build half hospital and leave. They're not running the country. The corrupt ruling elites take the resources out of the country and sell them at knockdown prices for their own, you know, to line their own pockets. And the puppet governments are puppet governments. But the people that run the country are the civil society and the women's group in particular in the country. The systems for people to report and escape domestic violence in a highly gendered society are just phenomenal. And it's a real example of how civil society can self-organize, even in the most repressive of situations. So I just wanted to segue a little bit with that, because we see the pictures of things burning in Haiti. What you don't see are the people sitting around drinking beer, singing songs and talking politics all day long. In fact, when the violence started, when it was really bad in February and March, I spoke to one of my friends out there. I actually sent him a WhatsApp. I just said, how are you all doing? And he'd been able to send his family out of the country. He'd seen the signs and they'd gone to stay abroad with relatives. He said, look, we're just drinking beer because what else is there to do, right? And maybe tomorrow we can't drink beer. And it really took me back to the first time I went there and met these friends. And they're all in similar jobs, you know, police officers, or they're computer scientists or they're accountants. And I'd had a baby when I was 25, 26. I should know that, which I thought was fairly young to be a parent. And they all thought I was mad. That was really old, because you have your children really young because you don't know that you're going to live into your 40s because of the violence, right? Not because of, you know, these middle-class people, they have access to healthcare, all of this, but because of the violence. And it's always important to me to recognize that my friends are living through this. And I'd probably be coping the same way, sitting down, drinking beer and talking politics, because what else is there to do as your country burns?
All of that's extremely powerful, so thank you for that. If you think about how Aristide reacted to being overthrown in 1991, what do you think the coup taught him and its aftermath? Obviously, there's then this coup regime that comes in for another 3 years. What does Aristide learn as a result of that time away from power?
I think it's fairly clear what he learns from what he does afterwards, but also fairly clear from what anyone would learn, which is, if you want to run a country and the military can overthrow you, you need to have more power than the military. And that's where we start seeing the formations of gangs to support Aristide. And this is why I don't like the term gang, but I've not yet to come up with a better one. These are supporters of Aristide who are meeting violence with violence. And remember, we've now had hundreds upon hundreds of years of violence, from plantation owners to international interveners to murderous, torturous dictators. And now the military is part of the violence, part of the coups. And so these gangs spring up. And within this idea that Aristide is going to be in many ways a savior, right? He's going to help with literacy and jobs and economic reforms and social policy and healthcare and housing and all of these things. These gangs aren't necessarily bad. They're there to support their leader to take forward these very important changes in the country. The problem is that when you have violence, violence itself is bad. But that's what Aristide and his supporters learned from that coup. And that really begins, you know, we can trace this back to the Tontons, but that really begins this idea of civil society gangs in the country that are hyper-political. They're also very interested in money and in sexual violence and in all sorts of things, drug trafficking, that gangs are interested in. But what's unusual about them compared with gangs in other countries in the region is how heavily they're involved in politics, and that stems from this moment in time.
I mean, the other element of this that we have to talk about in relation to Aristide post-91 is the influence of the Americans, which we spoke about earlier. America had obviously occupied Haiti for 18 years earlier in the 20th century, but they play a very important role in Haitian politics in the 1990s as well. And is it correct that, I mean, I think there's some dispute about this, but it's been alleged that Aristide made some kind of deal with the United States in order to bring himself back to power. How true is that?
I don't know how true it is. Certainly there seemed to be some form of pressure on the United States, from the United States on the military. You know, the military was sort of, there are those that say the US said, well, we'll invade if you don't return to sort of democratic ways, or the democratic path. But it's murky. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out there about US interference, and particularly around the Clintons. But there are elements of truth as well. It's very difficult to know what that involvement was, what role the US played. But we saw the military back down. Now, remember, a threat of a US invasion, even if it wasn't true, even if it was a whisper stream, falls back to some people's living memory at that time of the US occupying the country. So it was not an empty threat, and it's not an empty fear. And certainly that became a turning point for returning Aristide. But if we go back to that fork in the road, it wasn't the same Aristide and it wasn't the same country 3 years later. Seems a short period of time, but so much had happened that it wasn't that he could just pick up where he had left off before.
No, of course not. I mean, partly because of, I imagine, the sense of cynicism that he would understandably have by that stage. I mean, it's very interesting just to talk about the States. I mean, Dybert, again, in his book, he references, or he alleges that as a condition for returning to power in 94, Aristide signed a World Bank austerity treaty for Haiti, which reduced the import tariff on rice drastically. And as a result, Haiti went from being basically self-sufficient in rice production to being the fifth largest importer of American rice in the world. And much of the rice that we're talking about was produced in Arkansas, Clinton's home state.
And this is where it's outrageous. And it's not only then. And we talk about aid, right? I don't like this idea of international aid. I call it, you know, justice, redistributing wealth, returning, you know, righting colonial wrongs. But we call it aid as some kind of great charity. But we're talking about aid to a country. And people think, oh, that's great. We provide money or support or resources. The United States provides rice to a country that is perfectly capable of growing its own rice, right? That's not what Haiti needs. And if you go to the markets or, you know, the streets, and you see people have set up sort of market stalls, they've often got these bags, the sacks from US rice. Right? So the US can then say, oh, look, we provided all this aid to Haiti. No, you didn't. You bought rice from your own farmers, stimulating your own economy, and flooded a market that didn't need it, thus taking away economic stability and security for those rice farmers. So it's not only that it happened then, it continues to happen today. And it's the same with many countries in terms of aid. You know, when people think about donating to aid agencies or big international NGOs, I'm astounded because it's the civil society on the ground that needs to be supported, not international actors who are very often self-interested.
You mentioned that it was impossible or it would have been very difficult for Aristide to have picked up on his sort of reformist, populist, pro-poor agenda in 1994 when he took over again. His second stint at the presidency is relatively brief, and then he comes back again in 2001. Do you think he... I mean, obviously, this is asking you to go inside his head, but do you think he knew that? And do you think he cared by that stage?
Well, his second go at the presidency is very short because he's constitutionally barred from standing again. Then he comes back, and I think at this point there's a fatigue that sets in. The economics and the social inequality in Haiti are getting worse at this time. There's not the same excitement, strength of feeling for reform that he'd had in that first moment after the first elections. And it's increasingly clear that the work he wants to do is going to take a very long time to come to fruition. I think by the time we get to 2001, Aristide and the Lavalas party has changed significantly. In a society that has been ruled by violence and corruption. It's very difficult to root that out immediately. And we see this across the world. I mean, I think about Mugabe and the great support for Mugabe, this great reformer who's turned into a despot. You might say the same about Benjamin Netanyahu, right? Who's clinging on and continuing in a war just so that he can stay in power. There becomes this point where it doesn't happen to all men in power, but where power corrupts even those who come in for the right reasons. And you can look at the external factors. You can look at the internal factors. You can look at the personality of the man himself and his supporters. It's very difficult to know what the tipping point was. But certainly the figure that stood there at the beginning of the 1990s was very different to the figure that stood there at the beginning of the 2000s.
Can you just mention as well and elucidate some of the continuing issues related to gang violence with Aristide by this stage, and how the gangs that he had formed, partly to protect his own power base, were sort of progressing through the country?
So at some point, these gangs go out of your control. And the gangs that were set up, or the followers that supported him in the 1990s, had their own children by the 2000s who were growing up in gang lands, in areas controlled and run by gangs, some for the good, some for the bad, often with violence, often with sexual violence. And it is those children in the early 2000s, growing up then, who are the gang leaders today. Not all of them, you know, but who are certainly running these gangs, even if they're not the leaders. And you can see the children, the next generation of children, who are manning the barricades front lines. And you can already see the generations that are born and raised in this cycle of gangs and gang violence. And that began with Aristide. There is a direct line. Now, some of the rhetoric coming from the gangs sounds very Aristidean, if that's even a word. It becomes populist, and it's about political change and socialism. But you look at the actions of these gangs. I mean, the sexual violence, the waves of sexual violence in recent months, let alone in recent years, burning of entire places to the ground, the mass displacement, the hunger, the food insecurity. This is not socialism. You know, it's about as related to socialism as Stalin was to communism. But you can hear the rhetoric and the language is very linked to those original principles from Aristide. And I say all this knowing that there are people who I respect immensely, who do very important work. I'm thinking of a particular organization of public interest lawyers in Haiti, who stand by Aristide today and who won't hear a murmur of criticism against him or his policies or his principles. But I think we have to view that Aristide that they're supporting as very different to the Aristide in 2001, who seems to be being upheld in the cycles of violence today.
This is a very tragic story. And from Aristide's point of view, it's easy to sense how he would have been extremely disappointed by his presidencies. And in 2003, the influence and the actor that he takes aim at is an external one, as politicians often do when things aren't going particularly well at home. And that actor was France. Going right back to the start of our conversation, you mentioned the reparations that Haitians were forced to pay to their former slave owners in France. What did Aristide say about France in 2003?
He demanded reparations. He simply demanded, and I cannot understand why every person in Haiti and every person who cares about Haiti is not still demanding reparations. Hmm. You cannot expect a country to buy back individuals because they are property. And if you have done that and you've cancelled that debt, it's because you knew that debt was wrong. It's not like France can't afford to pay back these reparations. The NHS in this country costs £250 billion a year. We're talking less than what we pay for our National Health Service in
reparations. I think $21 billion, right? Was the it's the New York Times recently referenced that it was $21 billion.
Yeah, so we're talking about a tenth, you know. And that figure might be slightly outdated that I use for the NHS. I use it whenever I'm talking about how much the UN doesn't cost compared with National Health Services. Because I think that, you know, people hear reparations, they think, oh, that's terrible. It will cut the economy in France. It wouldn't be noticed in France. The problem is that if Haiti can demand reparations and get them, that creates the same domino effect that Haiti overthrowing the empire and banning slavery creates. And for many countries, that's a huge threat. They don't even want to return goods that they looted and put into museums, let alone pay back reparations to countries that they colonized and stripped of their natural resources. And this comes back to this idea of international aid, international interference, that the aid machinery, the international aid machinery is just a new form of imperialism. And that if you really want to remedy past wrongs, it's actually through paying the money or providing the raw materials that are needed to create the infrastructure that was denied to countries like Haiti through this. But so there's a threat to France, but it also is a threat to the European nations. And it's also a threat to the United States for what it's done to its own indigenous population and to its own African-American population.
And to Haiti. Because they're complicit in this too.
And it's also a very socialist agenda that was being pushed forward by Cuba in the United Nations, for example, by Venezuela. And we know that the United States was not willing to even engage with those countries, let alone support those kind of moves. And so it brought the US back to that point in the Cold War where they would prefer to support a murderous dictator, Duvalier, than allow Haiti to move towards those kind of systems of governance and political systems.
I mean, not very long after this episode, Aristide is removed in another coup, and he doesn't come back after that. There are right-wing groups that had been, I think, organizing across the Dominican border, and they came back into Haiti and overthrew Aristide. I mean, again, it's difficult to know these things for sure, but the New York Times ran a big piece, I think last year or 2 years ago, alleging that the French had been complicit in the attempt to remove Aristide in 2004. How much credence do you lay in that?
Again, it's very difficult to know. Even currently, it's very difficult to know. I read things, I see photographs from people I know of gangs holding American-made guns, South African-made guns. Very difficult to know how these weapons are getting to places, which international actors are interfering. What we do know is that what's happened in Haiti throughout its history is international interference. And it's always murky as to who is interfering. Even the assassination of the president, which some people allege kickstarted this latest cycle of gang violence, I think it's always difficult to pinpoint the moment. That was it's very unclear who the mercenaries were and who was behind it. Even now, there are different theories. What we do know is that at that point, the very fragile shoots of democracy start failing in Haiti. And then we get, once again, an international force, a UN force that comes in. And once again, Haiti's essentially all but occupied. And so we had a sort of good 10, 15 years of potential democracy that just gets wiped out. And even, you know, the last few days, just to bring it back to the present day, this transitional council that's been implemented, there was hopes that transitional council would have civil society members, it would be representative, that it might move towards free and fair elections. And not only did they appoint a president, they've also announced a prime minister, even though they didn't have a mandate to do so. A man who was previously the sports minister in Haiti. Now, I'm not sure if I offered, a lot of money to most people I know in Haiti, whether they knew they had a sports minister, let alone who he was, right? It wasn't top of anyone's agenda in the last few years. And again, it's this political corruption, it's puppeteering, it's putting people in place. And are they being put into place because of the corrupt elites in Haiti or the ones that live outside of Haiti but are Haitian, often living in Dominican or Canada? Are they being put into place by international actors or by the US? Or is it simply that the beginnings of democracy were crushed so quickly after the first elections that there needs to be far more support for actual democratic transition in the country? It's really hard to know. And it's always really hard to know when things are burning around you. You know, it's easy to take that step back now and think about what happened with Aristide early 1990s. But I'm sure at the time people didn't realize this was crushing the shoots of democracy.
I think the really, I mean, in terms of support that you mentioned there, just as a final question, the really sad thing about Aristide's story is that I don't think he ever really had a proper say or any real influence. The influence that he had was completely illusory. Do you think, just as a final question in terms of international support, if you think about the American and the French and the British and you know, the kind of, you know, the Western global North today, the people that run these countries, do you think that they actively want Haiti to remain poor? Do you think that they actually care about Haiti, or do you think that they do care and they can't find any way to actually change it?
It's a really good question. There's certainly what we call donor fatigue where it comes to Haiti. You know, how many times can we put our hands in our pockets and give money to Haiti? Well, not give money, give rice, send out people to build half a hospital. So there's definitely donor fatigue, but there's also, if you think proportionately, quite a disproportionate attention is given to Haiti only ever during bad times, right? Cycles of violence.
Yeah.
I never turn on the TV and see someone interviewing Haitians about the new hospital that's been built in Mirabalais or the latest, you know, literary festival or the Haitian women's football team. You know, these are things that happen like in any country. Even news outlets that do report far more globally, like Al Jazeera, don't do good news stories about Haiti. It's only ever the bad news stories. But there is a lot of discussion of Haiti, including in English language media, which is unusual because usually the English language media reports on former colonial countries of Britain. Whereas the French language media will report more on Mali or on Haiti and places. I think that there is still a huge amount of racism, whether it's known about or not, whether it's on purpose or not. This idea that we can support El Salvador and Honduras and Mexico and Colombia to come up with their own solutions to their own problems, but Haitians are never supported to find Haitian solutions to Haitian problems. I think that can only be put down to racism. It can only be put down to this being the first black sovereign state and the racism against black Haitians, telling them that they can't rule over themselves, that they don't know what's best for them, that they don't have their own solutions to problems. And it's the kind of thing that often stops an interview when I say that live on TV, because people don't want to acknowledge that racism is coded into the DNA of the United Nations. It's coded into the international machinery that was developed during times of empire. I think we don't confront that. We can't move forward. But the only way forward is to support the Haitian police force, who've been doing heroic efforts. Now, yes, some of them left, and I would probably leave if I was facing gang violence and was a police officer. But many stayed. They were defending the airport. They were defending the country. And many civil society, like civilians, making their own militias to defend. And I don't mean sort of, you know, gangs. I mean doctors and teachers and regular people defending their communities. The only way forward with this is to support the Haitian police force, to support the military, which was only allowed to reform in 2017, so it's still quite small and still doesn't have huge capabilities or experience, to support them to come up with their own solutions and to support Haitians to elect a government that the police and the military will want to follow, not just another puppet or corrupt government that the police or military won't trust, because that's the only way that you actually start having a functioning state. What I fear is going to happen is that under the guise of the international community being worried about the gang violence, and it is horrific, this violence, there will be yet another international task force that doesn't understand the context, that is not Haitian-led, that is not Haitian solutions. And that comes straight back to the point of this infantilizing, racist approach that Haitians can't govern over themselves.
I was just sort of thinking about the original revolution in Haiti, and I was sort of pondering the idea that the revolution was brilliant for the rest of the world, but it's been awful for Haiti.
I think given the conditions of brutality that those slaves lived under, it was the best thing for Haitians at that time. And I think countries like Venezuela and Cuba, when they used to have more resources, particularly Venezuela in terms of oil, petrol, they have provided as much support as they can to Haiti because they know that revolution was the best thing that happened in the region for everyone else. But I think we could actually go a step further back. I think the slaughter of the indigenous population and the shipping of black African slaves over to Haiti meant that Haiti will always be viewed differently in a more pejorative, racist way than any of its neighbours, where the colonisers realise why slaughter the people when you can enslave them. It's deeply soul sad. I would say soul destroying, but it's not soul destroying for me. How can it destroy my soul when Haitians are standing there saying it's not destroying their soul? But I think the more that people understand the history and context of what's going on, the more that people will stand up and say, stop sending in. They want to send in a Kenyan task force. They don't speak French. They don't speak Creole. They don't speak the third language, which is Spanish. And trust me, if you speak English in Haiti, you're not going to get very far. They don't know the local context. They don't know the areas. They don't know the different gangs, the different political parties. They don't know the civil society actors. It's going to be a disaster.
Rota, that's been a very humbling conversation. If people want to find more of your work on Haiti or on other things, where can you direct them?
I direct them to put my name, Rosa Friedman, into Google, and they'll quickly find my University of Reading webpage with publications. But they'll also find, if they put the words Rosa Friedman and Haiti into Google, they'll find lots of videos of me talking about Haiti. Much of what I've written on Haiti is actually related to the Haiti cholera claims and when Haitians tried to sue the UN for bringing cholera into the country, and on the sexual exploitation and abuse by peacekeepers in the country. I'd also really recommend people look at the work of Nicolas Lemay-Ebert, who's a professor at the Australian National University, and of course, Michael Dibert's work in terms of English language. In terms of, if you want a French language, 100% go to Haitian Voices before you come to any of us.
Thank you, Rosa.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Hated and the Dead. If you've enjoyed this podcast, follow it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and for good measure, leave us a review. You can also follow The Hated and the Dead on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, so you never miss new content.